I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The firings of 8 U.S. attorneys last year took center stage on Capitol Hill today.
The decisions to seek the resignations of a handful of U.S. attorneys were properly made, but poorly explained. This is a benign rather than sinister story, and I know that some may be disposed not to accept it. But it's the truth as I observed it and experienced it.
That's the man who organized the firings, former Justice Department Chief of Staff Kyle Sampson, who voluntarily testified before Congress today. Sampson said the attorneys were let go because they did not sufficiently support President Bush's priorities. He said there is no distinction between firing a U.S. attorney for performance reasons or for political reasons. Senate Judiciary Committee Chair Patrick Leahy immediately rejected those claims.
Regrettably, what we've heard from the administration has been a series of shifting explanations and excuses, and a lack of accountability or even acknowledgement of the seriousness of this matter.
The Democrats' ire seemed to be fueled today by the Justice Department's release last night of more internal emails and a letter of apology for misleading senators. Joining us on the line from Capitol Hill is Gail Chadwick, who covers Congress for the Christian Science Monitor. Gail, overall, what struck you so far about today's hearings?
Well, I think there was, as we were led to believe, not yet a smoking gun in these hearings, but Democrats say they are laying the groundwork that will be clearer in further investigation. They had a special briefing with reporters yesterday and tried to take a little bit of the fire out of these hearings, in the sense that they didn't think that anyone was going to walk away absolutely convinced one way or the other, or that there would be a clear gotcha moment that would play forever after.
Well, let's listen to some of the groundwork being laid, because here's Vermont Democrat Patrick Leahy questioning Kyle Sampson about whether Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez was involved in the firings of the federal prosecutors.
Was your email correct that Attorney General Gonzalez was present at a meeting on November 21st, at which there were discussions about U.S. attorneys?
I don't think the Attorney General's statement that he was not involved in any discussions about U.S. attorney removals is accurate.
By the way, that was Senator Arlen Specter speaking. But to some, Gail, that would sound like a gotcha moment. Is that Sampson turning on his former boss?
Well, he's laying a larger picture here. The Attorney General himself has made clarifications about that. That's one of the problems here. He's had to restate what he's told Congress so many times that he has lost all credibility with members here. And that is, I think, why there is such a groundswell that he needs to step down. But what Sampson also tried to do was to say that this was a process that was discussed when Mr. Gonzalez was Attorney General designate, that he agreed to the principles that when a 4-year term is up, there ought to be broad consultation about whether the individual should stay on. And I think one of the most interesting comments to me was when he said that even when he discussed the final list with the Attorney General, his concern wasn't the people on the list, it was whether the proper procedures had been followed in seeking the judgment of senior Justice Department officials. Almost everything he says around the process emphasizes this point, that it was the collective judgment of senior Justice Department officials.
Well, the crux of the debate is whether U.S. attorneys should be fired for political reasons. Kyle Sampson, as we said, indicated that he felt it's perfectly legitimate to do so. Here's what he said about that.
The distinction between political and performance-related reasons for removing a U.S. attorney is, in my view, largely artificial. A U.S. attorney who is unsuccessful from a political perspective, either because he or she has alienated the leadership of the department in Washington or cannot work constructively with law enforcement or other governmental constituencies in the district, is unsuccessful.
Gail, we've spoken before about this. There have been firings of AGs in other administrations, but rarely midterm. And in this case, the suspicion is that they were fired for not pursuing Democrats aggressively enough and pursuing Republicans too aggressively. How did lawmakers respond to Sampson's take on this?
Well, that is just what they were getting into when we broke. But one point I wanted to make about his definition, there's a whole sequence in his prepared statement that he didn't actually say so your listeners wouldn't have heard it. I'd like you to just expand on it. He defined this notion of being unsuccessful. You can be a highly skilled lawyer, he said, and a wonderful person, but if you can't maintain the morale of and motivation of line assistants, if you're, and this is something I suspect they're going to question him about, if you're resistant to the president's or the attorney general's constitutional authority, if you lose the trust and confidence of important local constituencies in law enforcement or government, if you fail to contribute to the important non-prosecutorial activities that come with positions of leadership, then you're not performing at a high level. I mean, it's more specific than I've heard anyone be about what this other definition is. You know, when you hear a political, someone is fired for political reasons, in any other context, that is negative on its face. They're trying to define for the public another category of judgment. And whether he's successful in that today, I think, is a very important element of this story.
Well, if in fact they're asserting that political observations are, you know, a part of the process, why then is the administration trying to obscure presidential political advisor Karl Rove's involvement in this?
I think that's going to be a very troubling point for them. That's one of the first lines of questioning that senators pursued. They went over emails. Senator Leahy did one email after another. What did you mean when you said Carl's shop? Was that Karl Rove? Yes, it was. Now, all the early assertion that the White House was not involved in planning or replacing U.S. attorneys has been thoroughly contradicted by emails, and that was confirmed in sworn testimony by Mr. Sampson today.
And what about the prospects, we got about a minute left, that Karl Rove or former White House counsel Harriet Myers might be subpoenaed? Are negotiations still underway to avoid the subpoenas and have them testify before Congress under oath?
Negotiations are underway, but given all the lapses in memory of Mr. Sampson today, I don't see how they get around a real showdown over that issue, because the emails, the documents, what limited points Sampson did make on this point show that, contrary to the initial assertions that the White House had no involvement in planning or replacing U.S. attorneys, in fact they did.
And by the way, just to expound on that in just a couple seconds, Kyle Sampson also said, I don't know or I don't remember, quite a bit.
Yes, that was a blow-up at one point. Chairman Leahy said, we really want to know what you do remember. He's being very careful here. This is perjury. Everyone is remembering what happened to Scooter Libby facing jail time. This is a very serious business. The one flashpoint when Senator Cornyn, Senator Schumer, and Senator Leahy started disagreeing among themselves is whether it's right to force Sampson to answer yes or no, mm-hmm. or whether he should be able to spell out exactly what he means.
As you said, serious business. Gail Chad at Christian Science Monitor in Washington. Gail, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
Well, a terrible fire in a Bronx row house this month that killed several children moved New Yorkers, but also introduced them to the ways of a previously closed community of immigrants. The two wives of one man from Mali were living with their families on separate floors of that building. Our next guest says immigrant communities can often be incubators for cultural practices like polygamy, forced marriage, maybe even more so, than their home countries. Pakistani-born Kishwer Faulkner is one of two Muslim female members of parliament in Great Britain. She's in the House of Lords with the distinguished title of Baroness Faulkner of Maghrebeen in Boston for a forum on understanding and reporting on issues facing Muslim women. And we welcome you, Baroness Faulkner.
Thank you.
What is the biggest problem facing Muslim women in your mind?
If I were looking at it from a cultural perspective, I would say it was Muslim men.
Because?
Because I think, to a large extent, a very male-dominated set of cultures across the Muslim world tend to marginalize, to some extent, Muslim women. And Muslim women in those countries have fought back quite successfully, as we've seen, because they're engaged in politics, they're journalists, they're involved in professions. Several countries have been led by Muslim women. But in the West, it is still proving to be a struggle because migrant communities haven't adopted, I think, at the same level, adopted mores and values at the same level in terms of women's equality. That is a battle that is already being slightly won in the majority countries themselves.
But what are you seeing in communities in Britain?
In Britain, It really breaks down according to whether people are first-generation migrants, where women don't really have voice still. And the second and third generation, who are, of course, born in Britain, who are pretty much products of Britain's culture of equality and non-discrimination, and who are beginning to thrive. You know, we have voice in politics, in the media, in business, across the board, and we're becoming increasingly visible and vocal, and it's a lively debate. It's great fun to be part of that change.
Fun, or is it frightening in some ways? I think of other Muslim women who have, like you, achieved positions in politics. Ali in the Netherlands, whose life was threatened. When you challenge the rights of women, are you accused of attacking the culture?
Well, yes. I mean, we recently had a debate on forced marriage in the chamber. We're trying to bring about civil prohibition on forced marriage. And I used examples of court cases from Pakistan where forced marriage is banned, but yet there's less than full support on the part of the security and judicial apparatus. And I was accused in the chamber itself of demonizing Muslims by bringing up these examples and so on. So, yes, you do get attacked, and you get attacked on all sides, but that's what raising your head above the parapet is about. It's what, in my mind, leadership is about.
What are the problems of Muslim women when it comes to their ability to earn for themselves?
That's a very patchy picture. It's a pretty poor picture in the United Kingdom. We looked at some statistics for pensions and discovered that 76% of women from Muslim backgrounds in Britain are economically inactive. Now, of course, this may be through choice, and I suspect in the older generation it's less through choice, more through culture. In the younger generation it may well be through choice, where perhaps couples are becoming more conservative and don't believe that giving your children out to childcare is the way forward, and they decide to stay at home themselves and bring up their children. It's, you know, I think the important thing is that it should be based on choice and not on discrimination whereby you can't get jobs or not being held back by your own community because you're not allowed to fulfill your potential.
What kind of role do Muslim women play in the current debate over who is going to own the soul of Islam? Whether or not Islam, you're nodding your head yes.
Yeah, it's, you know, that's a potent question, and it's a very difficult one because I believe that there are, I know of very very well-founded theologians and women who are jurists who look at Sharia law and various other aspects of the interpretation of Islam. However, there are far fewer numbers of them than there are men. So in terms of affecting the debate, I think it's going to be a very few number of female voices and much more male voices.
That's Baroness Kirshwar Faulkner, one of two Muslim women members of parliament in Great Britain. We'll have more with her. Reminder, later in the program we go to Tehran for reaction from Iranians to the seizing of those British sailors. Back after a quick break, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're back with Kirshwar Faulkner, the Baroness Faulkner of Maghrevine, one of two Muslim female members of Britain's parliament. And Baroness, I wonder how much addressing the violent fundamentalist strain of Islam is entwined with addressing how women are treated in Islam.
We have to leave the terrorism and the violence on one side and then address perfectly legitimate questions about modernity and Islam and how Islam might be interpreted in today's world, which is a very different world from 1,500 years ago. And while there may be fundamentalists who are political extremists, they live in democracies, they abide by democratic traditions of democratic descent, yet they have the right to exercise free speech, just as right-wing talk radio does.
You say you purposefully listen to voices from the right on American radio. Why? What are you hearing there?
You know, when the Danish cartoons happened, we thought that it was European media who were slightly irresponsible, if you want to put it that way. And Mr. Bush came on and said, oh, well, this could never happen here, and the media here in the United States were terribly responsible. Well, I discovered when I accidentally listened a couple of times, just in you know, doing the washing up or something, that actually what was coming out of reactionary right-wing media in the United States was far more full of hatred and vitriol than anything in Europe. So I started listening on that basis because I really couldn't believe this was happening, and I identified with, you know, one or two people who simply didn't know any better. As I have listened, I begin to see a real pattern of quite bright people choosing to be rather selective in the facts, because where they're coming from, in my opinion, is to increase, increase skepticism about whether Muslims can be good American citizens or not.
For instance, what do you hear?
Well, how long have you got on this program? The way to solve the problem in the Middle East is to nuke Jeddah, Riyadh, and Baghdad. You hear about how women have no rights whatsoever. And I'll give you another good example that comes to mind. There was much reporting of some figures to show that 70% of Muslims believe in jihad. This was extrapolated on this talk radio station to show that that meant 800 million Muslims out of 1.something billion agreed with this. There was no attempt to explain that the meaning of the word jihad is struggle. It can be an internal struggle. It can be a struggle to be good, to improve yourself as a person. When I say that things are decontextualized, that's what I refer to.
No, one of the concerns in Britain is that the Muslim community increasingly was isolated, shut off from the rest of the country. In this country, there are pockets of Muslim communities in Detroit, Michigan, for instance, but Americans, by and large, haven't had as much of that experience. First of all, how much of a problem do you think it is in Britain? I mean, do you think it is a problem?
Yes, I've done quite a lot of work and spoken quite a bit on spatial segregation, and because I think ultimately spatial segregation leads to those poor schools and poor housing and sets you aside from the rest of the community.
But is it self-selected segregation? I mean,
yes,
in that case,
to some extent, it's voluntary segregation. I myself worry a little bit about that, but I worry about that much less than the fact that the welfare state does have an element of social engineering in it. Certain aspects of the welfare state would tend to cluster people together in the belief that being with your own people gave you more comfort when you were new. And that's not necessarily unreasonable as thinking. I think when they did that in the 60s and 70s, they didn't see the long-term implications of essentially having spatial segregation lead to living very separate lives, where in fact mainstream values were not known, and there wasn't development towards them, and there wasn't attempt to understand each other's values and to live and work with each other.
It's reminding me that there was a piece in the Wall Street Journal, I don't know if you saw it,
no,
about anecdotal information about Muslim cab drivers at the airport refusing to take rides if they have alcohol.
That's right. I've been familiar with this story for some time, actually. I'm interested the Post has finally caught up with it. Yes, I mean, I feel very concerned about these low-level incidents that don't help social cohesion in any sense at all. I mean, I absolutely, you know, a cab driver who doesn't want a disruptive and drunk passenger has all my sympathy. I wouldn't want to be in a public vehicle with even a bus with very disruptive or drunk passengers. And that's quite right and fair. But simply not to take passengers because they happen to be carrying alcohol that they bought duty-free is, I think, ridiculously intolerant. And if they don't respect the fact that in this society people do drink alcohol, then maybe they need to find jobs where they won't have any interface with any of that part of society at all.
That's kind of a tough love. Words to your fellow Muslims. I mean, do you feel safe saying that?
Yes, of course I feel safe. You know, Americans worry, I think, a little bit too much about those of us who take rather clear lines in terms of where we wish our community was and isn't. There have been people who have stood up and said what they believed was right and wrong. I wouldn't be here today if I wasn't prepared to say that. I wouldn't deserve to be where I am. I'm a lawmaker.
And what would you say to Americans who might say, well, wait, I was saying the same thing and I was called intolerant of the Muslims?
No, I wouldn't do that. What I was asking was for a more nuanced debate. And I think where the right is right, I'll be the first person to say that I agree. And I think what I wonder is whether these sort of broadcasters realize of the effect of the drip, drip, drip of undermining others and making others feel less valued as citizens. That's what disturbs me.
Lady Kirshwar Faulkner is a life peer in Britain's House of Lords. She speaks today at the Elizabeth Newfer Forum on Human Rights and Journalism, sponsored by the International Women's Media Foundation here in Boston. Lady Faulkner, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And we have a quick note from Washington. At the Radio and Television Correspondents Association dinner last night, President Bush got in a few jabs. Here are some highlights.
A year ago, my approval rating was in the 30s. My nominee for the Supreme Court had just withdrawn. And my vice president had shot someone. Ah, those were the good old days. Sorry, the vice president couldn't be here. Said he was going on vacation to Afghanistan where people like him. You know, I'm considering what's next. President Clinton, of course, wrote a very successful presidential memoirs with 10,000 pages or something. I'm thinking of something really fun and creative for mine. You know, maybe a pop-up book.
President Bush last night, shouldn't he be busy with other things? They also got Karl Rove to do a rap song. If you want to see that, go to our website, here-now.org. Still ahead, the music of Toscanini. You're listening to Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The British government says it's seeking UN condemnation of Iran's seizure of 15 British sailors and marines in the northern Persian Gulf. Iran warns it might put the British Navy crew on trial. Iran is holding to its claim that the British crew was in Iranian waters. Britain is convinced the crew was in Iraqi waters when it was seized by Iran last week. Borzu Dargahi is Middle East correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. He's in Tehran. And Borzu, that's the standoff internationally, but what's the conversation in Iran? What are people there saying about the seizure?
Right now it's the Persian New Year holiday, so it's kind of like a winter break here. Most people are on vacation. Most newspapers aren't publishing. I wish my newspaper would have a policy like that during holidays. And it hasn't really hit a critical mass yet with people here, but it is being talked about. And one of the things that was really interesting, and it's sort of melding into the whole domestic political debate that's going on here, that's been going on here for 28 years between hardliners, reformists, opposition figures, and so on. And for the first time, just over the past couple of days, we've heard some of those moderate dissident voices speaking out, being critical of the government for its brinksmanship and adventurism with regard to this issue.
Well, we know one of the opposition figures has called it a blunder.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a real sense that that this is a really pushing an already tense situation in the Persian Gulf to an even higher level. On the other hand, you have people here who feel, people in the government who feel somewhat betrayed by the international community. They feel like they have nothing left to lose. And they're basically saying that, look, you may think that you're defanging us with these UN Security Council resolutions on the nuclear issue, but we still have a few arrows in our quiver. Here's one of them. We're going to, you know, spark this major international crisis. We're going to create problems for Tony Blair back in London. We're going to send oil prices hurtling up. They're showing that with a little gesture like this, they can really shake the boat.
Well, and we should say that while we have heard that there were opposition voices saying that it was a mistake, we're also reading in your paper about conservative students burning effigies of Tony Blair.
Yeah, you always have that crowd here in Iran. Today they were demonstrating, I believe, in front of the foreign ministry, calling for the death penalty for these sailors. They haven't even had a trial yet. But, you always have these real hardline elements in the society. I think every society has them, these hardline right-wing types.
Have you heard any conversation around the comment the British Foreign Secretary Margaret Beckett made? She said, it's a source of astonishment to me that it doesn't seem to dawn on the authorities in Iran that behaving in this manner increases rather than diminishes people's concern about how Iran would behave if Iran had a nuclear weapon.
Yeah, I think she had a very, very significant point that she was making about the way this is being viewed by the international community. It just seems to a lot of people that in the international community, in the region, that Iran is out of control. On the other hand, it could very well be in control. This could all be very calculated, an attempt to demonstrate to the international community that if you put too much pressure on us, we have ways of fighting back. Right now, you've got to consider that the U.S., the British, even the French are flooding the Persian Gulf with military hardware. In addition, you've got the situation where they're holding these five Iranian diplomats in Iraq, alleged diplomats, I should say. And so they're putting all this pressure on Iran, And, you know, Iran knows what's going on, and they're basically saying, look, you put all this pressure on us, we can make a real mess.
Well, you know, I'm suddenly thinking of the Gary Powers situation. In 1960, the U.S. flyer shot down over Russia, who was eventually exchanged for a Russian spy held in the U.S. You mentioned the Iranian diplomats held in Iraq. Has there been a suggestion of an exchange?
There's been no official suggestion of an exchange from the Iranian government. However, there are, you know, we mentioned earlier these sort of hardline elements, many of them semi-official organizations, charities, organizations devoted to honoring the memory of the martyrs of the Iran-Iraq war, folks of that type, these sort of ideologically motivated hardliners who have been calling for that.
Well, this dispute comes as the Arab League summit is going on. You're also following that. Has there been pressure from other countries on Iran? Have other countries weighed in on this?
I wouldn't call it pressure, but I think that a few countries that are considered intermediaries between the West and Iran have tried to play a role in this matter, one of them being Iraq. The Iraqi diplomats have good relations with both the U.S., and the Iranians. And another one, of course, Turkey. Turkey has been lobbying the Iranians, trying to get them to release these folks, trying to cut some kind of deal to diffuse attention in the region. These Arab League summits are always a time of diplomatic posturing where the foreign officer corps of the various countries tries to bolster the status of their country. And so this, some view this as an opportunity to come out looking really good and very powerful in the region by brokering a truce.
Yeah. Borzu Dargahi, Middle East correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. And Borzu, listeners are used to hearing you from Baghdad, but you have actually been traveling back and forth to Baghdad from your home in Tehran for 5 or 6 years now. So put this in context for us. You know the country. Where would you put this on the scale? Is it Iran tweaking Britain? Is it going to grow into something bigger? Where do you place it?
A similar incident happened 3 years ago in the same area, the Shatt al-Arab. That one was quickly diffused, but in that one also the sailors that were caught were kind of treated poorly, mock executions. They were, you know, tied up and blindfolded and stuff like that. So, you know, we're not sure exactly how this has come about, and I think that's the key. That one was absolutely a case where, you know, something happened, an incident happened in the waterway, and, you know, then it escalated a little bit. But here, we're not exactly sure whether this was pre-planned by the Iranian authorities to detain these guys, or whether it was more of an incidental thing that happened. And, you know, I think that if it was pre-planned, that would be uncharted territory, and that would be bringing this to a higher level of crisis than if it was just an accident.
And just briefly, as to the treatment of this group of detainees as opposed to the one 3 years ago, we've only seen glimpses. Seaman Faye Turney, the sole woman, told an off-camera interviewer that the crew did trespass into Iranian waters, and some have said she looks slightly nervous and flushed. Do you have a sense of how they're being treated?
I think just, you know, taking prisoners and putting them on television, I think that violates, certain international rules and norms of conduct when it comes to holding prisoners. But it looked from the videotape that they were being treated while they were eating and watching TV. It was in stark contrast to the videotape we saw with the last group of prisoners 3 years ago who were being, you know, led blindfolded through the desert.
And we should say British officials have also said that it's completely inappropriate to put the prisoners on television. Borzu Dargahi, Middle East correspondent for the Los Angeles Times in Tehran. Borzu, thanks as always.
It's been a pleasure.
Okay, before we go today, the maestro's maestro. 50 years after his death, we re-examine the legacy of Arturo Toscanini and the beautiful music his baton produced. You're listening to Here and Now. Question. You think it's a good time to start a new newspaper? Ad revenues are down at USA Today and the New York Times, and the newspaper industry has started a campaign to spread the word that news of its demise is premature, that rather being made obsolete by the Internet, more people are reading newspapers online than read Yahoo News and MSNBC.com combined. But traditional paid newspapers have a new competitor, free papers. An Icelandic company is launching a new free paper here in Boston next month. If it works, the plan is to roll it out across the country. And John Wilpers, editor-in-chief of Boston Now, joins us with more. Welcome.
Hi, thank you.
Well, to remind people, free papers make their money off of advertising. A lot of mainstream papers are starting their own free sheet just to keep people like you at bay.
Yep.
Boston has a free paper, the Metro. It's got two other papers that have gone free, the Phoenix, the Dig. Why another one?
We think there's room for a paper that approaches the news differently. We are going to invite the community into the paper.
You're going to use bloggers.
We're going to use bloggers throughout the paper, in every section of the paper, every section of the website, because we think that one of the problems with traditional newspapers is they're out of touch. And they're out of touch because the people who run them tend to be a very small group of people who don't have a whole lot of contact with the rest of the community at large. And so if we bring bloggers in from all areas of the community, we're going to have a reach and a relevance that's going to be incomparable.
Okay, a couple questions on that. First of all, here's what one blogger had to say. Wow, you're giving me the rights to reprint my content for free. What a deal. Maybe you can sell me a bridge, too. Are you paying them?
We're going to start out as with what we think is a terrific bargain. We're going to exchange exposure to 150,000 readers a day for their content. 3 to 6 months down the road, we're going to develop a compensation program. Right now, nobody is paying bloggers anything. Most bloggers have audiences in 2 to 3 digit range. They're going to go to 150,000.
Well, and the other key here, and this was a point of contention for many paid newspapers, you will allow the bloggers to keep the rights to
Absolutely.
Their material.
The bloggers keep the rights to their material. The videographers keep their rights to video and photography.
But are you going to edit these bloggers? I mean, would they even let you?
We would edit the bloggers if they appear in the newspaper. And by edit, I just mean we will look at them. We will not change the voice or the tone of the blog because that's basically what blogs are about, that color. We obviously would not allow libel or obscenity. But beyond that...
Fact-checking?
We would not fact-check if it's on the web. If it's in the print, we would probably take a look and make sure they're not completely off the reservation. But by and large, we've looked. We spent a good month and a half going into Boston area blogs, making sure there were enough there, making sure the quality was what we would expect, and they are.
Well, now I just want to be clear. You are going to have a webcast. In fact, you're going to webcast your editorial meetings.
Every day, twice a day.
Scary. But let's just take on that for a second. Are you really going to webcast a meeting in which you're discussing breaking news so other papers can hear it?
We will discuss everything but our cover story.
Okay.
Because our cover story is going to be not the news you read on the web yesterday. It's going to be something you haven't heard of yet.
But the bloggers are going to be in the paper.
Yeah.
In the paper.
Yeah, they're going to be in the paper, either in a brief form or even in a story form. For example, if AP is covering something and a couple bloggers want to go too, I think having a multiplicity of viewpoints would be a great thing.
Well, to have a free sheet in Boston is one thing. There are several free papers here. Do free papers work in cities that don't have mass transit, where people aren't running and grabbing a paper to get on the bus?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I consulted with the Nashville City paper. They don't have mass transit much to speak of. It's people, when they get into the city, they'll pick up the paper either after they park their car, they'll read it when they get to their desk, they'll read it at lunch. Free papers have a place just about anywhere where there's a concentrated population in a city, that's it.
What about the fact that some of these papers, including yours, these free papers, are owned by overseas companies?
On the surface, it would look like a problem, but it's really not. Russell Pergament, the CEO, got the funding and got also editorial and financial control. Mm-hmm. So we do not hear a thing from them.
One last concern people have, litter. One more paper to throw out on the...
Right.
On the subway?
I believe that because so much of the paper is going to be a refer, so to speak, a referral to the web, it's going to be short stuff in the paper, and we're going to say, if you want depth, go to the web, because in my mind, the day of depth on dead tree newspapers is gone. Yeah. The depth is where it should be. It's on the web. So people will have to take our paper with them because there'll be so many links that they're going to want to follow when they get to work.
John Wilpers, editor-in-chief of Boston Now, a new free paper making its debut in Boston, and they hope to roll it out across the country. It's owned by a company in Iceland. John, thanks so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
And when we come back after a quick break, the music of Arturo Toscanini. Stay with us here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. I am no genius. I have created nothing. I play the music of other men. I am just a musician. Those are the words of perhaps the most famous conductor of all time, Arturo Toscanini, who this week would have turned a mere 140 years old. Despite his humility, Toscanini was worshipped in his time. In fact, his broadcasts with the NBC Orchestra made him the American idol of his day, that popular and accessible. Arturo Toscanini is also remembered for his unwavering opposition to fascism before and during World War II. He was strongly critical of Benito Mussolini, refused to conduct at Germany's Bayreuth Music Festival after Hitler came to power, and helped establish what would become the Israel Philharmonic Orchestra. 50 years after his death, the name Arturo Toscanini still resonates for classical music lovers. To remind us why we should occasionally be reminded of this great Italian conductor, producer Sarah Fischko shares her thoughts about the life and work of Arturo Toscanini.
I'm trying to get through the Toscanini maze. It starts and ends with music, of course, but in between, there's this man stamping his feet and waving his arms to get his way. There are powerful disagreements about his gifts and decades of musical tradition and remarkable history. Arturo Toscanini, for one thing, perhaps the most internationally famous conductor in history, rose to instant stardom when he put down his cello and jumped up to the podium to fill in for the conductor at a performance of Verdi's opera Aida. It was 1886. He was 19, and it was the first time he'd ever conducted. The last time he conducted a live performance was 68 years later, in 1954. By that time, he was the first conductor to have appeared regularly on television and was certainly considered the first true media star of the conducting world. So just by nature of having covered so much ground, Toscanini is of major interest. And now we have books, recordings, DVDs of his broadcasts, exhibitions with annotated scores and photos to help us consider the question, what did he actually do? Some answers come from the NBC Symphony players who worked under him. For one thing, he rehearsed like crazy. Bassist David Walter interviewed 15 years ago.
When you're playing in an orchestra, there's always a little push and pull. If you get a very good conductor, you get close to what he is thinking, but never exactly, and that's the thing that haunted Toscanini. For him, that was a frustration that lasted all through the years.
To get exactly what he wanted from 100 players at one time, Toscanini is said to have done everything a human could do. Yell, sing, dance. In his heyday, the press loved to write about his histrionics, his physical and mental excesses. Violist Harold Coletta remembered some years ago that it was not all invention.
He was extremely sensitive in every way, and very harsh at many times, and very, very cruel with his insults. He was like a child. Who couldn't control whatever he felt. There was spontaneity and sometimes very ugly spontaneity with his insults.
And he was cranky about visiting conductors who did things differently. There was a memorable moment with conductor George Zell.
When Zell came to conduct this, he liked to pick and pick and pick and pick, so that as we were rehearsing, we would mark down on the jackets of our music, we counted 128 stops in the rehearsal of the first movement of a Haydn symphony. Toscanini had been pacing up and back in the 8H studio. At the intermission, he came storming down the aisle, screaming at Zell. He said, "How do you expect musicians to play?" He says, "We keep picking at them, picking at them." He says, "Let them play." He says, "They'll show you how it goes."
Toscanini, it is said, with all his vocal and physical demonstrations, was much more businesslike.
With Toscanini, you got such a sharp, delineating beat, you knew exactly what he was looking for. He would go after the key points that he wanted, get it cleared up, and then he would conduct from beginning to end. He would work very intensively, and when he got what he was looking for, he would say, "Basta, go home."
He was also blessed with a phenomenal memory, especially when he was conducting opera.
Allegro agitato,
He knew all the lyrics, all the words, and he would sing them in his falsetto, sometimes a little out of tune or like a whiskey tenor, but he knew every word.
So with all that, did Toscanini make great music? Well, there's debate about that. Joseph Horowitz's book, Understanding Toscanini, written nearly 10 years ago, insists that making great music was not what he was about. He says Toscanini and the media of the period reduced music to a kind of middle-of-the-road, masterpiece mentality that's been seriously harmful. Harvey Sachs, on the other hand, a biographer of Toscanini, sees him as deserving of our admiration for his great contribution to music. He brought conducting into the modern age, say his supporters. Continuing through the maze, I begin to listen to some famous Toscanini recordings. The Dvorak New World Symphony recording of 1953 is one people talk about, and it has an excitement that is undeniable. I can hear the strong rhythmic element he was famous for. Listening to it, you can see how Americans might have learned to love the famously anti-fascist Toscanini, self-made conductor, who left Europe in the 30s and settled in at NBC here in New York, with an orchestra made just for him, and a custom-built studio, too, where he plowed his way through the great classics. Later, when he turned up in the early days of TV, it was practically the first time anyone, other than the musicians in front of him, had seen a conductor's face at work. Think about it, says his grandson, Walfredo Toscanini.
The television cameras brought them around to the other side. That was a revelation, and that will last forever.
No conductor ever received the kind of adulation he did in his days traveling around the country, sometimes accompanied by his grandson.
We traveled by train, and people would just come to the train station, and grandfather would come out on the back platform.
Life magazine said Toscanini was as famous as Joe DiMaggio.
It was an adventure, and the youngest person, the one with the most energy, was my grandfather, and he was 83 or 84 years old.
It's hard to imagine now an era when a conductor could mean so much, when a classical concert could be a major cultural event. That's where I come out of the maze. I can't get too involved in criticizing, picking apart the performances. There's too much other information there about music and the culture of that era. To watch and listen is to see how one person, stamping his foot and waving his arms, captured the undivided attention of 100 players and a whole world of listeners. For me, that's plenty.
Our exploration of the life and work of Italian conductor Arturo Toscanini was produced by Sarah Fischko. Last Sunday would have been Toscanini's birthday. He died 50 years ago this year. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.